The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
We have main engine start. 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, listeners. Welcome to the Tuesday Space Show. It's great to be here, and we're going to have a terrific program tonight. Let me get right into the announcements so I can introduce both of our guests to you. For those of you who would like to call us during the show, that toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. Remember, no call screeners. Let it ring until we can answer it, and we'll bring you up on air just as quickly as possible. For those of you who like letters instead of phone numbers, our toll-free number is 1-866-68-SPACE. That should make it easy for you to remember. Email dmlivings@yahoo.com, drspace@thespaceshow.com, and thespaceshow@gmail.com. For those of you who prefer to be with us on chat, remember we're with the AOL family for chat programs. That's IMICQ or CompuServe, and the screen name is the same for all of them. One word, Space Show Chat. Please remember we're trademarked and registered, but you do have permission to download the shows, copy them, and distribute them and pass them around. Nothing commercial with the shows and no changes or modifications to the text of any of the interviews. And for podcasting, we thank Andrew and Gigadial.net. Please remember we're in Podcast Alley. We're iTunes compatible. The RSS to subscribe to our podcast is on our website and both of our newsletters. Let me hear from you if you have any questions or problems or suggestions at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And then please remember also that is our website, thespaceshow.com. Our comprehensive, detailed newsletter is there. It's uploaded every Monday morning, California time. Not only does it have full details and bios for the week's programs and guests, it has a coming events section. And if we have to change programming or make an announcement, this is where you'll see it first. So check the website newsletter from time to time. If you want the short email newsletter sent out, it also goes out Monday morning. It's just one or two lines about the week's programming. Send your request to drspace@thespaceshow.com. Everything we do is archived. You can access it without any registration or login. Download the shows freely. Go back and listen to some of the old shows. They're historic, especially when you have an opportunity to hear guests that have been on from 2001, 2002, and they're still around and still on the show in 2008. So listen to some of those old shows. And we have a store on our website. Check that out, especially during the holiday period. And then remember, we're a 501c3 nonprofit with the One Giant Leap Foundation. The truth is, we really do need your support for doing this show. It is costly to do things in space. I say this all the time. It is also costly to do a space radio show. And we couldn't do it without your support. So we thank those of you who do support us and those of you who will be supporting us in the future. And we couldn't do it without you. Remember also, the Space Show is now brought to you in part by Secure World Foundation. They are sponsoring us. And Secure World promotes cooperative solutions for space security. Check them out at their website, secureworldfoundation.org, and listen to their programs that they have done with us and that they will do with us in the future. And then ATWIC is going on this week at NASA Ames. If you're not there, you should be there. The debate today with Pete Warden, who's the director of NASA Ames, and the NSS person, Gary Barnard, on space solar power was fabulous. I hope they put it up on YouTube or something so that all of you can hear it. If I had to choose a winner, 100 votes for Pete, maybe one or two for those supporting space solar power. Pete was outstanding. AIAA is having a big meeting in Orlando, January 5th through the 8th. Check that out at AIAA.org. Remember also we're in Twitter, we're in Facebook, and we are in MySpace. So tonight, excuse me, we have a treat in store for you because Dr. Tom Jones is back with us, and also for the first time we welcome Dr. Alan Stofan with us. They have a new book published by National Geographic called Planetology, Unlocking the Secrets of the Solar System. Tom is a planetary scientist, author, speaker, and former NASA astronaut. He flew on 4 shuttle missions. He's led 3 spacewalks to help his crew install the Destiny Lab, centerpiece of the ISS. He is the author of Skywalking, an Astronaut's Memoir, and Hell Hawks with Robert Dorr. He writes frequently for Aerospace America and Air and Space Smithsonian. I'm sure you see him do space coverage, shuttle flights, and other space news for Fox News. He's a board member of the American Association of Space Explorers. He writes, consults, and speaks, and does all of this out of Houston. And you can find out more about his work at www.astronauttomjones.com. And Alan Stofan is also a planetary geologist who has conducted research on the geology of volcanic and tectonic features on Venus, Mars, Titan, and right here on Earth. And while an employee of NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab, she was the chief scientist on NASA's new Millennium Program and deputy project scientist on the Magellan mission to Venus. She is currently senior research scientist at Proxima Research and honorary professor of Earth Sciences at University College in London. And she is over in Virginia on a farm. How nice.
Yes.
Ellen and Tom, welcome to the program. How are you both?
Thank you. We're doing great.
Ellen, do you have light pollution on your farm? Can you see the true night sky?
It's actually pretty good out of here. We're about 55 miles west of Washington, D.C., so it's pretty dark.
Totally cool. For people who haven't seen a night sky without light pollution, they are missing something beyond words. Your book is great, and the pictures are unique and outstanding. So how did you get the idea to do it? Were you all good friends? How did you end up collaborating? Do the 101 on the book.
Okay, well, I'll start for just a bit. Ellen and I were graduate students at the same time studying planetary science, and she was up at Brown, right, Ellen?
Right.
And I was at the University of Arizona in Tucson, and so she was up in Rhode Island. And so we were both working as fellow graduate students under NASA funding, and there was a conference at the end of our work where we all got together to present our research projects in 1988, and I think we met there for the first time, and she went off to work at Jet Propulsion Lab, and I went off to work in Washington as a NASA contract scientist. And we wound up meeting together again about 2 or 3 years later when I was a new astronaut candidate down in Houston, Texas. So on a field trip to Jet Propulsion Lab, I ran into Ellen again, and we would always compare notes. And then, incredibly, we wound up 2 years later working on the same project where her Jet Propulsion Lab was furnishing the radar instrument for the first space shuttle mission that I was assigned to. And so we got a chance to work very closely together for about 3 years to the run-up of 2 shuttle flights called Space Radar Lab. And I'll let Ellen pick it up there.
Yeah, on the Space Radar Lab, Tom was responsible for making observations on both of our shuttle flights, which took place in April and October of 1994. And the instrument, we were using it to look at all aspects of the Earth, the geology, oceanography, vegetation, land cover. So we were really doing a comprehensive study of planet Earth with the radar. And I was responsible for sort of organizing the science team and organizing our observations. And also training the shuttle crew. So, of course, Tom and I got to spend time together, and we started thinking, wouldn't it be really nice if someday we could write a book that would explain what it is we do and how all of this is really looking back ultimately towards the Earth and trying to understand how planets work.
So even when you look out at volcanoes on other planets, you're still applying this back on Earth.
Exactly. Ultimately, what you're trying to do is to understand how a volcano works. And when we have volcanoes to study here on Earth, we really have sort of a limited set of patients, if you will. They're under certain conditions, Earth conditions, you know, temperature, pressure, rock composition. So when we go out to Venus, we go out to Mars, we go out to the icy satellites of Jupiter and Saturn, where you're not even erupting, you know, liquid rock anymore. It's now water ice that is the rock out there that's now erupting as liquid water. All of these conditions are basically volcanoes that erupt, and so you're starting to understand the basic physical process much better by having all these different examples to study. So then you come back and look at Earth volcanoes, and you have a much better understanding of how the process works. So that's really what we're trying to do. It's comparative planetology.
Is there a huge difference in the way a volcano works on another planet or the moon of a planet versus what it does on Earth?
Well, it can be, yeah. For example, on Venus, there's very low water content on Venus, so you would never get the big explosive eruptions. Water in a magma or liquid rock helps drive those big explosive eruptions that you get. So, for example, on Venus, you'll never get eruption plumes, those big clouds that come out the top of erupting volcanoes. They would never go as high up into the atmosphere. You'd never have deposits around a volcano that would go out as far. So every little thing does make a difference, the temperature, the pressure, the exact kind of rock you have.
You know, in the back of the book, you have on page 152, Wind Sculpts the Landscape. And I looked at this picture of the red surface. I really thought I was looking at Mars until I read the caption, and it's in China.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the amazing things about circling the planet, is trying to put all of these lessons that you learn in the classroom about the geology of the terrestrial planets, and specifically our Earth, into play as they unroll before your eyes. And so I was up there with the Space Radar Lab team on my two crews in 94, working with Ellen's group of scientists on the ground, and we were trying to observe and keep track of and analyze images from about 400 different science sites around the planet. And when you soar over a place like China, and then soon after, a couple of orbits later, be over Australia, you began to see the similarities between continental geological features. Different continents, you might think they're a world apart, but you see these great similarities all around the planet. And then you extend that out to the same kind of information we're getting from the latest spacecraft imagery from around the solar system. So you see these wind-carved shapes in the Gobi Desert of China, these large overturned boat-shaped ridges called yardangs. And then we see the same features sculpted by the wind on Mars, on the flanks of the tremendously large volcanoes there. And even more startling, we find sand dunes, not only in the deserts of China and the Sahara and the American Southwest, but we find sand dunes on Venus and Mars, and also on the frigid, you know, almost absolute zero plains of Titan. We see particles blown into sand dunes by the very sluggish winds there. It's just truly amazing, the parallels between these surfaces across the solar system.
Is sand the same on all these different planets as it is on Earth? Is a sand dune a sand dune?
Well, different compositions for the tiny grains. You know, here they're largely quartz grains on Earth, cut free from rocks by water erosion or freeze-thaw cycles during the winter and seasons. But on Mars, those dust particles are much smaller, and they're usually broken loose perhaps by those thermal cycles rather than any kind of active water erosion today. But there's a lot of dust on Mars that gets blown into these sand dunes. It takes a lot longer, though, tens of thousands of years, for a sand dune to form on Mars than it does on Earth. And we suspect that the sand particles, the sand-like particles on Titan, are particles of hydrocarbon solens, is the term. They're chunks of organic material that precipitate out of the atmosphere, cling together, clump together, and form hard, rock-like particles that can be moved around by the thick atmosphere of Titan, even though the temperature is something like 200 degrees below zero there.
You know, your book makes the case for space being the best mechanism possible for our learning to be good stewards of planet Earth. So I'm looking at this series of phenomenal colored pictures. I need to find out if you colored them or if this is really how they were taken. But this is on the gorillas. And Ellen wrote the caption about the Virunga volcano chain in the Congo.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And the colors are, you know, they're nothing like I've ever seen in my life on Earth.
No, that's actually a radar image, and it was part of this mission that Tom and I have been talking about, the space radar lab that flew on the shuttle in twice in 94, and this was one of our images from that mission. Most people are used to looking at planetary images that are taken in the visible wavelength range. So, you know, the typical wavelength range of the energy spectrum that our eyes see in. So a pretty typical camera. A radar camera is a different part of the spectrum, and most people are used to having their cars shot at by police radars. A radar has much longer wavelengths. And it's valuable because, for one thing, radar has the ability to penetrate through clouds. So on places like Venus, Saturn's moon, Titan, that are cloud-covered, you can penetrate through those clouds and actually get an image of the surface. On the Earth, and in that particular image you're talking about, which is of the region that's along the border between Rwanda and the Congo, it's where the mountain gorillas live. And, you know, most people have heard of the movie The Gorillas in the Mist. Well, that pretty much tells you that area is typically cloud-covered. So one of the reasons we were anxious to study it with the radar is we'd gotten a request from some people who were working to protect the mountain gorillas. And they were interested in trying to understand more where the jungle, you know, how where the jungle where the gorillas live, what the extent of that particular habitat was in that area. And so we could take this image with our radar, and those different colors that you see in that image are actually different wavelengths of the radar. Some of the wavelengths are a little longer and some are a little shorter, but the combination gives you a very good ability to say, okay, this area is rocky, this area is jungle, this area is much more likely to be cultivated crops. And so we went ahead and gave this image to the people that were trying to help the gorillas so that they could better understand the extent of the gorilla habitat.
So does green mean vegetation?
Yeah, the blues and greens in the image are the different types of vegetation, and the kind of yellows and weird purples are the lava flows from the Virunga volcano chain, which extends in that region. It's really an amazing region, and just unfortunately has been war torn for quite some time.
Now, you have an insert of a mountain gorilla. You didn't image that from space. You just
No.
put it in there, right? Cameras
No,
are not that good.
People found that one for us.
They're not that good yet, are
No.
they?
That's one of the most appealing aspects of the book, I think. And Ellen and I both really enjoyed working with the staff at the National Geographic Books Division because they had access to their years and years of imagery, spectacular photography taken here at ground level on our planet. And, of course, we used their talents to find pictures that complement all of the orbital Earth images and the robotic spacecraft planetary images that we bring back across the solar system. So you have a human eye view of these geological features and the processes that operate on this planet. And we also understand then more viscerally how they operate on other worlds as well.
Tom, do you remember approximately how high your orbit was when you took this picture?
Oh, sure. The radar image of the Virunga volcano chain, along with all the other radar images in the book from Space Radar Lab, was about 120 statute miles or so above the planet. So pretty good for a human observer looking down at the planet, and just the right altitude so that our orbit would drift westward on each pass and then repeat every day a sweep over the same scientific site. So in each of these 11-day missions that Ellen and I worked on, we would come over the same site each day and have a slightly different look angle. And we were able to then use varying geometry of the radar beam to tease out more information and really size up whether the radar would be an effective tool for studying all the different disciplines in the Earth science. It's really a tremendously powerful monitoring tool, and there are right now several radar-equipped satellites, unfortunately none from the U.S., but equipped to look at the Earth's ice fields, volcanoes, ocean currents, and even some of the ecological changes going on the planet.
You know, I can't see how environmentalists and others wouldn't jump on the space program to, demonstrate, what we need to do and how better to care for our planet here. I just I don't think there's anything that is as compelling as looking at Earth from these cameras and these views from orbit. I mean, it really tells us what's right here and what's going on. I know from the new space community and some of the other parts of the space community, the environmental movement is not always supportive of space, but they need to get your book. And, I mean, it's amazing. I wanted to ask you about this double-page picture group. You could call it Spotting Freckles.
Oh, the image of Europa.
Yeah. Can you help me understand what I'm looking at?
Well, that image is most of the images that come back from the satellites of Jupiter have been amazing. And Europa, which is one of the larger satellites of Jupiter, is certainly an interesting place. It has an icy crust, as all those moons do. They're dominated by water ice. But the surface of Europa is covered by an amazing number of fractures, all kinds of cracks going in every which way. And it also has all kinds of spots and bumps and what look like basically freckles all over the surface. And first with the Voyager data and then with the Galileo spacecraft that was in orbit around Jupiter several years ago, we've really started to try to understand what's going on at Europa. Europa has a sort of a, there's a lot of arguments going on, but somewhere between about a 1 kilometer thick and about a 100 kilometer thick icy crust. Below that crust is actually a liquid water ocean. Instead of having, like we do on the Earth, a rocky crust and then a mantle that's sort of partially molten, partially solid, on Europa they have this icy crust and then a liquid water ocean underneath it. And the movement of that ocean and probably subsurface volcanoes that are going on cause that ice on the surface of Europa to crack in all these amazing patterns, and so you have to study those cracks in detail, and scientists have been, to try to understand the history of what's been going on in Europa. And then sometimes the cracks actually are enough, or the heat coming from below is enough, that you actually are getting eruptions of this subsurface water ocean up onto the surface, and that's forming some of these funny sort of freckly bumps. And what we've done in this image and why it's all these different colors that make it even more dramatic is it's being looked at in multiple wavelengths to give you some information that there's variations in composition. It's not all just pure water ice. There's other stuff mixed in, and so that's why there's a variation in color across.
Charles from Boston sent in this email question and says, can you tell us if the oceans are salt water like here on Earth, or is it a different kind of water or a different substance?
Well, we're pretty interested in what exactly the composition of the water would be. It probably wouldn't be salt water like we have here on Earth, but it might have a lot of different elements in it. We're really not sure at this point. It probably has some percentage of organic material, because we know comets have delivered organic material all over the solar system. It's got, you know, some percentage of iron and other minerals in it. But exactly what that composition is, we're not sure. And right now NASA has been studying a major new mission to Europa that will hopefully be launched in the next 5 to 10 years, that would really give us a much better idea of the composition of exactly what the composition of those upper surface ices are, and a lot more information on how thick that crust is, so how hard it would be for us to really try to sample that ocean and see what it's made of.
That's one of the biggest challenges in space exploration. We've done the easy reconnaissance missions around most of the major planets, and now we're trying to accomplish things, as Ellen has mentioned, that are very difficult. Getting down on the surface of a world that circles the largest planet in the solar system and be able to survive the radiation environment and the thermal extremes and still manage to do an analysis, still manage to land someplace that's interesting and can give us those answers. And so there's going to be some very difficult work ahead of us as we try to employ a next generation of robots to get this detailed information.
Yeah, the first step for Europa is really going to be an orbiter. And then the follow-on mission that we're really only dreaming of at this point would be to get something down on the surface that could even maybe melt down through the ice and send a probe down into that ocean. That mission's a bit further off at this point. Technologically, it's still pretty challenging.
Do graduate students get to work on these projects? Does it depend on the school they attend, if the school is involved in the project? Or are these kinds of projects like the Europa mission or studying the images, are these beyond graduate school level?
Well, they're very much in the realm of what graduate students would do, especially on the scientific analysis of what's going on and what's being returned from spacecraft like Cassini and the Messenger probe at Mercury right now and the fleet of spacecraft around Mars. Graduate students are heavily involved with their advisors in performing the initial analysis and the interpretation of those images. Now, when it comes to actually designing a mission and putting the spacecraft design together to accomplish these next-generation exploration goals, then you usually need a team of experienced spacecraft designers and operators to pull that off. And so you would find people who are more mature in their careers and have a lot more experience than graduate students do. But it takes both groups working together to pull off a successful mission, both technologically and then scientifically.
I think the exciting thing I've seen over my career has been when I was in graduate school, the data used to come down on these huge tapes, and the tapes had to be, I'm really dating myself here, these giant tapes, they'd have to be sent around. You had this giant computer room with tape readers, and so there weren't that many universities and colleges that had the kind of equipment and infrastructure that was necessary to sort of allow you to be a participant, even as a graduate student, in these missions. But with the advent of all the data being so much more portable, so much more accessible over the web, the number of students that I've seen participating, the number of schools and professors who've gotten involved in doing planetary research has really exploded because it's just so much more technologically easy to deal with the data, and that's been a really great thing to see.
So you no longer have to be at a chosen university. You could be at a state university that participates in these programs.
Oh, definitely.
Harry in St. Louis sent in this message and said, a few minutes ago you mentioned the Europa mission being 10 years out or so. It must be very frustrating to see this much time go by in planning and implementing and carrying out a mission. Is this a function of money, or do these missions take this long to plan for a real reason other than financial?
Well, I mean, in the case of the Europa mission, there's actually two missions being studied right now, a mission to Europa and a mission to Titan, Saturn's moon. And the idea is that one of those missions will fly sometime in the early 2020s. So I think my 10 years was even maybe a little optimistic. And then, for example, the mission that doesn't get selected will fly at some point after that. And it is frustrating. It's not instant gratification. You see something exciting, like I study Titan, and you find something exciting. We discovered lakes several years ago on the surface of Titan, and boy, the next thing I'd like to do is be able to get down and land in one of those lakes and sample it. But that mission, is at least 10 years off, if not longer. And it's frustrating. It's technology. It's so all of the things you mentioned, the technologies are often challenging and need time to be developed. The money is limited. NASA only has a limited budget, and there's lots of things on NASA's plate and lots of really exciting good things to do. In the case of places like Titan and Europa, you then have to factor in it actually takes a long time to get there once you actually launch. So everything plays in. But when you're a planetary scientist, you sort of sign on to those kind of delays.
You could be retired by the time they do one of these missions.
Oh, don't say that.
That's the sad fact, David, is that, with the constant, relatively flat NASA budget and science spending about a third of that NASA budget these days, that envelope of spending only allows for a series or a sequence of missions that cost, probably around a billion-dollar mark or more to accomplish one of these outer planet, very sophisticated missions. And so those opportunities to sequence in those missions to various destinations takes, unfortunately, an unsatisfyingly long amount of time. And, that you can solve it by a couple of ways. You can, for example, choose to focus all your scientific efforts on one or two targets in the solar system. But unfortunately, there are eight big planets, and everybody has interests on many of them. Or you can expand the NASA budget envelope. That would be another solution. But right now, for the foreseeable future, there's going to have to be a definite sequence of shifting from a Mars mission to a Jupiter mission to a Saturn mission. And, of course, we have the planets we haven't even talked about that we want to get back to as well.
Is planetary science in the United States far ahead of other countries, or do you have associates in peers doing similar work, the same kinds of projects elsewhere?
It's really an international effort, and that's great because that's what you want. You want all the best minds you can find all over the world. And other space programs have really been just incredibly expanding. I mean, for example, there's an Indian, the Chandrayaan satellite that just got launched to the moon and is there taking data. They're going to get good results. The Japanese have a very strong space program. China's come on board with a strong space program. And, of course, the Europeans have had a very strong space program for years. And, in fact, I have I work on an instrument that's on a European spacecraft, Mars Express, that's at Mars. So it really is truly an international effort. The Cassini spacecraft, which I also work on the Cassini radar team, it was actually the Cassini-Huygens mission, and it's an international mission.
You have another question. This is Paul. You'll love this one. Paul is over in Minneapolis, and he says, I have your book. I love it, but there's one problem I have. You have a terrific set of photos on the solar system on pages 8 and 9, but you don't show Pluto. I know they've deplanetized it, but shouldn't it have been shown in our solar system picture?
Well, I think we were trying to show in that diagram an actual image of each of those planets. And because Pluto's so small and so distant, one of the reasons it's not there is because we just don't have a very good representation of it to show on that one. My sentimental feeling is certainly with Paul, because I think Pluto should be a representative of the solar system's family of planets. Even though it's only one of many similarly sized bodies, I think it should hold a special place in our hearts and be on that diagram. But we sort of went with the fact that we didn't have a very good picture of it. It would just be a speck of light or a fuzzy Hubble image, and so it didn't make muster on that diagram.
In your collaboration, how did you decide what to put in this book, what to cover? I mean, basically you have the universe at your fingertips, and you have far more data than we have. So how did you collaborate to come up with what's in here?
I think the newest thing that we wanted to try was not just tell the story of the solar system chapter by chapter, planet by planet. In other words, chapter one, Mercury, chapter two, Venus. That's been done and treated that way many times before. And I think what Ellen and I were intrigued by was the idea of treating the solar system as the result of a set of processes or forces that shape the rocky or solid faces of the solar system. So we wrote a book that examines the forces, volcanism and impact and tectonics and erosion, and went through the book that way and then tried to bring in some spectacular examples of each of those forces in each of our chapters. So that was a different slice, a different angle of looking at the solar system. Ellen?
Yeah, definitely. And I think we sort of sat down at one point, we went and had coffee and said, okay, what are we going to put in here? And it wrote itself, but it was a natural selection of things that were the obvious processes, wind, volcanism, tectonics, impact cratering, ice. The processes that shape the planetary surfaces are in a way fairly small in number. But then we also wanted to bring in, at the end, we sort of go beyond this idea of forces that shape planets and go to some sort of larger themes that affect the solar system that we were both intrigued by. And one of the chapters toward the end is on life on Earth and the possibilities of extraterrestrial life. And then the last chapter is on looking for planets around other stars. So those were sort of two going beyond, this our own solar system to larger themes.
One more question before we take our first break. Larry in Tucson sent in a note and said, if the forces are on Earth as they are on other planets, how come Earth is so much tamer than when we see what's going on other planets. I know we have an atmosphere, and clearly life can be supported here, but if these forces, which are so strong, are working on all the different planets, I would think they'd be equally as destructive and harsh on Earth, impairing life, just as it would be on another planet.
That's a good point, and there's some truth to what he's saying. For example, on Earth, we underwent a continued bombardment early in the solar system's history by objects tossed out of the asteroid belt, comets from the outer solar system, that went on for over half a billion years in the early part of the solar system's history. And we think that life was getting started almost at the 4 billion year ago mark, very early in the Earth's history. So there may be a period in Earth's history where life evolved, began to gain a toehold on this planet, and then was sterilized or wiped out by these repeated impacts. And perhaps life arose several times on Earth before it finally could hang on in the face of that cosmic bombardment, creating these kinds of violent convulsions of the early Earth. These days, though, in the last few billion years, the solar system has been a more quiescent place. Bombardment by asteroids still goes on, but at a lesser level. And I wouldn't think of Earth as necessarily a quiescent place even today. I think it's one of the most geologically active planets. It's got a very dynamic process of plate tectonics going on, which a lot of other worlds, in fact, we don't see it anywhere else in the solar system as active as it is on Earth. So I would say that, you know, the reason that we actually survive here today is not because Earth is a less violent place. It's just because our planet happens to be in the right habitable zone around our star to produce moderate conditions of temperature and pressure, and we have a large enough planet to retain an atmosphere over billions of years that can support life. The other planets in our solar system either fall outside that zone or have lost their atmospheres, for example, by bombardment or because they're too small and lack that gravity to hold on to that protective envelope. So we're in the sweet spot.
Let's pause here. We'll take our first break, and we'll be back with Tom and Ellen in 2 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of The Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
Welcome back, everybody. You are listening to The Space Show. And our two guests today are Dr. Tom Jones and Dr. Ellen Stofan. And I'm looking at a picture in your book. I have the advantage of having the book here, and I know this is radio, so the listeners don't get to see all the images I do. But this is page 66. It's a topographically colored image of Venus's complex rift zones. So, first of all, how is the coloring done, and what is that process about? I'm sure it's done by computers, right? But how do they know how to make this green and this red? What is the process for that?
Well, this particular image, which is absolutely spectacular looking, is a radar image of the surface of Venus that was taken by the Magellan spacecraft And this image is actually huge. It's several thousand kilometers, so well over 1,000 miles across. And what you're seeing is, first of all, what's giving you sort of all these weird bright lines and circular features, and there's some volcanic flows mixed in there. That's at the actual radar image, and the variations in brightness in that radar image are telling you something about how rough the surface is. Brighter areas are rougher, or slopes that are facing towards the radar, and darker areas are smoother. The colors that you see are, Magellan had two instruments on it. It had this imaging radar that took this image, and it also had an altimeter that was measuring the surface height. So the colors you see are actually that surface height information that we've, with a computer, superposed over top of the radar image. And the blues and greens you see are the low areas, where the bright yellows and reds are the topographically higher areas. So this rift area, actually, as you can see, that the area as a whole sort of is raised above the surface, while the rifts themselves are then cut deeply into the surface. This area is near the equator of Venus, and Venus is about the same size as the Earth. And it's an area where the crust of the planet, or the upper layers of the planet, are being pulled apart by extensional forces.
What if a human eye could see this from space, what would the colors be, or would you see any colors?
Well, unfortunately, if you looked at it from space, you know, if you were in orbit around Venus looking down, you'd see kind of orangey-yellow clouds that wouldn't satisfy you very much at all. If you could drop through those clouds, and if you could survive those 900-degree Fahrenheit temperatures on the surface of Venus, what you'd see around you would be sort of a hilly, sort of rough-looking region. Everything would look kind of orangey-colored because of the filtering effects of the Venusian atmosphere. The rocks are probably mostly black, lava rocks. The landscape would probably look vaguely Hawaiian, sort of. And I know most people, when they think of Hawaii, think of beaches. I think of volcanoes and lava flows. So that's what I mean by Hawaiian.
No palm trees.
No palm trees, no vegetation, lots of lava rock. Again, it would sort of have this weird orangey hue to it rather than a typical black rock you're used to. And the scenery would be quite dramatic, though certainly, you know, not on the scale of you know, the Himalayas or anything, but you would see quite a bit of hilly terrain, rough terrain around you.
And the radar cuts through the cloud cover without a problem.
Exactly, and that's why we sent this. It was the Magellan radar that was in orbit around Venus from about 1990 to 1994, and we mapped the entire surface of Venus, and it's an amazing planet. Again, it's about the same size as the Earth, and we needed that radar to cut down through those clouds and return the images of the surface, and it's so hot on Venus. That again, there's no vegetation at all. There's no water on the surface. But the surface is so interesting because it's just covered with volcanoes. It has quite a bit of tectonic activity, or this pulling apart of the crust and coming together, though it never has gotten a system of plate tectonics like we have here on the Earth.
When I first started teaching as an adjunct at the University of North Dakota, some of the professors took me out to dinner at one of Grand Forks' finest, probably their only finest. And one of the professors said, we really need to study more about Venus because it's where global warming has gone wild, and we can learn a lot about that and apply it to Earth. Is that a fair statement?
It really is, in the sense that Venus absolutely has a greenhouse atmosphere. Its atmosphere is dominated by CO2. A lot of what we understand of the effects of CO2 on an atmosphere, and again, this is where this whole point of planetology comes in. You know, we understand the effects of CO2 on an atmosphere quite well. The Earth has some, Mars has less, Venus has way too much. And when you put CO2 into an atmosphere, it acts as a greenhouse gas and warms the planet up. And in a limited way, that's a good thing. In the case of Venus, when your atmosphere is dominated by CO2, that's a bad thing, and that's why it's 900 degrees Fahrenheit on the surface. Venus would only be about 10 to 20 degrees centigrade hotter than the Earth because of its position closer to the sun. The reason it is so hot on the surface is because of its greenhouse atmosphere. So being able to study that greenhouse, understand it, understand how it evolved, how stable it is, why it went to this runaway level that it did, where it's right now it's in quite a stable position and it's so hot, is really important when we're trying to understand the ultimate fate of the Earth. Now, obviously, Venus didn't get its greenhouse from, you know, people, Venusians driving fuel-inefficient cars. It happened very early in Venus's history, maybe as late as a billion or 2 years into its history. At some point, Venus might have actually had an ocean on its surface. But at some point, water became unstable on the surface. The ocean boiled off, and the CO2 that was present in its atmosphere never got tied up in surface rocks like the CO2 in early Earth's atmosphere did. And why exactly that happened, how it happened, we're not sure, and there's a lot left to study at Venus to help answer those questions.
I can't believe you're getting this question. Boy, I have listeners that don't forget anything. This is Ben in Seattle, and he said several years ago David had a space tourism company on the show. I don't remember who they were, but they said they wanted to take tourists to Venus as a hot tourism place in the solar system, and they were dead serious. Do you think that anyone talking like this is loony? I can't believe that I heard that on the show. I should go back and find the archives as to who actually said that and see if that company is still around. Mm. Well, I actually do remember which company said that, and I have no desire to say anything negative, so I'm not going to mention their name. But yes, that was a new space company that is still around that does want to offer trips to Venus, or at least did at one time. I mean, how crazy is that?
Well, I think it would be a waste of your precious time spent in space. You know, the current ticket on a Soyuz rocket to go to Earth orbit for about 10 days is about $30 million. So obviously that price will drop as commercial companies begin to take tourists first on suborbital hops and then into orbit eventually. But if I was going to spend several months for an interplanetary voyage, I wouldn't go to Venus because, as Ellen says, your eyes just can't see the surface from an orbit around the planet. You can't survive on the surface. So for my money, I would spend it, you know, going to the moon or a nearby asteroid and actually get my boots on the surface of either of those places, do some interesting field exploration and trekking and an adventure exploration, and maybe even as far as Mars, which is a much more Earth-like planet than Venus ever has been.
What would you see at a nearby asteroid?
Well, the fascinating thing there would be it would be equivalent to rock face climbing. You're almost in free fall conditions, so there's really no up or down, and you'd actually have to piton yourself to the surface with a network of cables to work there. But you would actually be treading on rocks that are older than any on our planet or even on the moon. They date back to the earliest days of the solar system. You could be prospecting very profitably for resources like water, which could refill your fuel tanks or be used to support exploration in other directions as rocket propellant. And you've got your these asteroids are, of course, a hazard to us on the Earth, but you've got the potential then operating at them to turn them into beneficial resources. They could be the filling stations that we'll need to eventually support transportation routinely to and from Mars.
And we can do this in my useful lifetime? Remember, I'm 62.
No, in fact, NASA has just completed a study in the last year and a half that shows that the new Orion moonship, if launched in a different direction, actually has the capability to support a couple of crew members on a reasonably short trip to a nearby asteroid. So you can envision around 2020 or 2025, a couple of explorers heading out 5 to 10 million miles from Earth for a total of 3 or 4 months to visit a nearby asteroid, bring back samples. Samples can be returned by robots, of course, but intelligent sampling of an asteroid, thoroughly investigating its surface, and getting the civil engineering information you might need to divert a threatening asteroid would be invaluable information.
As both of you are planetary geologists, what about this? Would you rather have someone such as yourself, a trained planetary geologist, on the ground on one of these solar system bodies doing work, getting research, bringing samples back, or a robot?
Both.
Both? I didn't expect that answer. Why both?
Robots can do amazing reconnaissance. They can do things that to send a person to do would be, you know, not a great idea from, you know, a danger perspective or just a sort of broad cost perspective. On the other hand, ultimately, for example, for the question of, like, you know, are we going to find great fossil evidence of life on Mars, which I believe exists somewhere on Mars, I think it's going to take an astronaut, you know, whacking a rock with a hammer to find it. So I think there are great things that robots can do, and I think there are things humans can do, and we need both. I don't know how Tom feels.
Oh, I think that there's a case to be made that if you've got a very difficult scientific question to address, whether it's on the moon or on a nearby asteroid or on Mars, you're eventually going to need a human field explorer to get the answer in a reasonably efficient amount of time. Now, if you and I lived, David, 100 years and could spend 75 of those years being planetary scientists, we might be able to wait for several generations of robots to be developed to address a specific difficult scientific question. But to get them to all work in succession and work and return results in a reasonable time scale is not going to be a practical approach for those of us with a normal lifespan. So if you really want to address in your lifetime and mine the questions of whether biology ever got established on Mars, I think we're eventually going to have to, as Ellen says, put both machines and people on the surface to address the most promising areas. For example, if you have to drill down a couple hundred meters to find the traces of Martian life that might still be hanging on today or might be preserved near an ancient hot spring there, no robot is going to be able to put together a 100 or 200 meter drill string and make it operate perfectly at interplanetary distances. You're going to need people, trained scientists and engineers to actually operate that equipment. So I think that if we want the answers, we have to actually commit to that kind of exploration.
Could robots confirm life on Mars, or would we have to have boots on the ground to do that?
They could confirm it if they found it accessible. But other than scratching the surface or perhaps drilling down a couple of meters, I think to design mechanical equipment that can be miniaturized and then thrown to Mars and then expecting it to work perfectly without repairs and maintenance is not the approach that works on Earth. And I don't think we have the capability to make machines function perfectly for long periods of time to achieve very long, detailed scientific investigations on a place as harsh as Mars.
Tom, you have a question. It's off subject. I'm going to go ahead and ask it because we're coming up on our break. It really is a different subject. This is Lindy in Phoenix. And Lindy says, Tom, since you did spacewalking, one of the hottest topics that is promoted by lots of people is space solar power. Space solar power is supposed to be built or deployed or developed in GEO, which is quite a bit of difference from doing anything outside a spaceship in low Earth orbit. As someone who has spacewalked, could you assemble anything in GEO, assuming you could get there and be protected from cosmic radiation? Or do you think trying to assemble in the GEO orbit would be absurd for a human to do?
Well, I think the writer is correct that it's going to be impractical to have anything as large as a solar power satellite assembled by people. I think it would just be so tedious and take so long to do hand construction of a giant solar array that would be a phenomenally expensive approach. So you have to make the design simple enough so that a fleet of robots, very similar to each other and redundant to each other, could go to work assembling an array of that sort. And if one breaks down, then five others take over. And you'd make them very cheap and you'd make them very reliable, but doing very simple tasks repetitively to construct a large array that was built out of very similar elements. And I think there's actually some robotic work going on here on the ground that's very promising in that direction. And so you build simple machines that can build other simple machines and assemble large, repetitively designed arrays in space. That's the only way to do it. And the real key to making solar power from space a reality, I think, in the long run, is using materials that are out there rather than trying to haul everything up expensively from the ground.
As someone who has actually walked in space, would walking in the GEO orbit short of cosmic radiation hitting you be any different?
No, it would be just the same. You're in free fall, you're in orbit, and just falling around the Earth, and you just happen to be at a higher altitude, and so your velocity in the orbit is slower, but you have no perception of that. So free fall at 120 miles is the same as free fall at 23,000 miles. And I'll tell you, the view from GEO on a spacewalk would be truly stunning. To see the Earth as an orb you know, far beneath you. When I spacewalked, the Earth filled half the sky, and so there was always a natural tendency to think of that direction as down. If you were a geo, you'd be halfway mentally, I'm talking now, perceptually, you'd be halfway between the Earth and the Moon. It would be a very different and weird kind of disembodiment, I think.
So if height didn't bother you in Leo, it wouldn't bother you in geo?
No, in fact, in geo, you would not feel high. You'd feel adrift between two worlds, and it would be a very eerie and disconnected feeling, I think.
And your spacesuit would probably not protect you from radiation, would it?
No, it doesn't do a very good job. It's just too thin for that. It'll keep you alive and protect you from micrometeoroids, but over time you would sustain probably some damaging doses from the galactic cosmic rays as well as solar protons. So it's nice to do spacewalks below the protective sheath of a magnetosphere.
I would think so. Okay, we're going to do our break. Back in 2 minutes with Tom and Ellen.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of the Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Space Show. Our guests today, Tom Jones, Ellen Stephan. Planetary defense. I hear a lot about this. Rusty's been on the show many times. I know he's fighting hard for planetary defense and even for UN treaties about it. What do you have to say about the likelihood of Earth being hit by something that's potentially destructive as a planetary geologist perspective?
Well, the first thing I'll say is that it's certain to happen in the future. The Earth, as all the other planets have, has been struck many times by cosmic debris, usually asteroids in the inner part of the solar system, comets in the outer part of the solar system, and we can read that record in the craters that we see on the surfaces of Earth and the other terrestrial planets. And we have a whole chapter in planetology talking about impact cratering as a fundamental process that has shaped in common all of the worlds that we see in the solar system. The sources of the projectiles might be different over different periods of solar system history, but it's a fundamental process that batters and shapes and reshapes and resurfaces the landscapes of the solar system. Now, here on Earth, we're very parochially interested in this impact process because it still goes on today, and of course it's had major effects on the course of life and its evolution on Earth. We look back 65 million years to the destruction of the dinosaurs and about 75% of the other living species on the planet by the Chicxulub impact event 65 million years ago. And we know that Earth will be hit by another major asteroid in the future, one big enough to perhaps collapse our current civilization. Certainly we'll get hit by ones in the interim, that are big enough to get our attention or even cause local destruction. So that's an ongoing geological process that we can witness by going out under the night sky and looking up at shooting stars. They're sand grain type pieces of debris that strike the upper atmosphere. I've seen them burn up beneath me looking down at the Earth from the space shuttle. And I can see that cosmic bombardment going on the night side of the Earth every night pass that we take. We need to do something about that because we have the capability to, for the first time in the whole history of our species, and certainly in the whole history of the Earth, we have the capability to stop a process that affects all the worlds of the solar system. We know now with our space technology and with our telescopes how to find and track and eventually move them out of the way and keep a major impact from occurring on Earth to eliminate us. So for survival reasons, we should be worrying about tracking and finding these objects, and then we should at the same time be thinking about practical ways to nudge them out of the way. And that's some of the work I've been doing lately with the Association of Space Explorers.
Well, the Tunguska, I guess, was the last big one 100 years ago.
Right.
That hit us. But if you look at the dinosaurs, that was 65 million years ago. When was Meteor Crater?
About 25 to 50,000 years ago. It's one of the best examples on Earth that we can see of a fresh impact crater. And, of course, that was caused by an object that was only about maybe 75 or 100 meters across, a nickel iron object in that case that caused Barringer Crater. But the detonation on impact of that object was on the order of tens or actually hundreds of megatons. So it was a huge blast that would have pulverized any living things within miles of it. That kind of event occurs on the order of every few tens of thousands of years. We just had a dramatic event on December 6th when a fireball re-entered over Colorado. There was one on November 20th when another 2-meter-sized object re-entered over Saskatchewan, and we've actually found meteorite fragments from it. The Earth sweeps up about 100 tons of this stuff every day. These are fragments of asteroids and a few chunks of comets or comet dust. And so it's happening all the time. It just happens that every so often we get one that's big enough to obliterate a city. And that's the kind of event that Tunguska was. And we should be looking for objects that have that potential. And when we are confronted by such an object, it would be very prudent of us to have a plan in place about what to do. Currently, no such plan exists, and the Association of Space Explorers has just turned over a draft agreement to the United Nations for consideration, and that's the work I've been doing the past couple of years. And it's so graphically evident when you look at the Earth and the other planets in our book and in the imagery from spacecraft that this goes on all the time, and yet so far we've managed to ignore it.
If you were a statistician and you were playing and showing probabilities and you were equating probabilities to a dollars and cents, and I've heard this argument said on the show before by different people, you would not invest in planetary defense because the probability is so low of getting hit that the cost of trying to do something about it is way out of proportion to the risk. And again, they're playing pure statistics, pure math, pure probabilities. What would you say to the person making that comment?
Well, very briefly, I think it's incorrect. I think that the costs of preventing a future asteroid impact are pretty low. They amount to the cost of a few hundred million dollars spread over a couple of decades just to prepare a couple of satellites or robotic missions to go and investigate some practical methods of deflection. So nothing out of scale with the kinds of scientific missions that we've already mounted to other worlds. So not expensive at all in terms of space program expenditures, a very minor expense there. Essentially, we've been driving around the solar system lately without insurance. And so it's time that we invested a little bit of money in understanding the threat and then laying down some ground rules for the international community to agree on how to cooperate when we eventually do have to deflect one of these away from a target zone on Earth. And when that threat confronts us, as it will in the next couple of decades as our catalog of asteroids grows, there's going to be a lot of attention internationally paid to this problem and how to resolve it. And if we don't want to have a panic-driven response, it's time to discussing and planning and investing a little bit in the solution right now.
People who want to go to Mars say, you know, we have to be able to get humans to Mars to save humanity. because we're going to be hit like we're talking about right now, and at least we'll have a remnants of society to start again, or humanity, on Mars. What have you to say, or both of you, about that argument for going to Mars? I personally think it's ridiculous. But
Ellen, what do you think?
Well, I would go in the ridiculous is maybe strong, but I think our primary job is to make sure that our own Earth is inhabitable.
Absolutely.
And sustainable. Above all, I'm all in favor of sending humans to Mars and exploring Mars, but the way but to me, looking at it as some sort of
Life
where we're going to save ourselves is not very logical.
No, I think it would be more effective to try to intervene with the incoming than it would be to try to take 100 people to Mars.
Yeah, I mean, it's just,
And I won't be selected for those 100, so.
Well, I largely agree with you two, but philosophically, there is, over the long run, the obvious fact that if you live on just one planet, you're not going to survive over millions of years. We might be able to deflect asteroid impacts that we can track and predict over the course of decades or centuries, but we don't even have the technical capacity today to deal with a long period comet that comes in from the outer reaches of the solar system. We just don't have an energetic enough way to deflect an object like that, given the short warning that we would have. We can't catalog those objects in the same way. So, over the long run, it's important that we become a space-faring species with our toes on other worlds besides Earth, so that we do have an ultimate survival plan.
In the May or June issue of The Atlantic, I forget which one, I saw it when I was at ISDC in Washington, the lead cover article, and it was by someone who does environmental writing for The Atlantic, and he's also, I think, with the RAND Group, said that the sole and only mission of NASA should be planetary defense, and he used a lot of Rusty's work in the article. He had obviously talked to Rusty quite a bit, although I'm not sure that Rusty shares that focus of NASA. I don't know. But he said NASA should abandon all projects and its only reason for existing and taking public money should be to develop planetary defense against an incoming. I can't imagine you two would consider that to be an appropriate position for NASA to take.
No, not at all. I mean, the work that NASA does under its mission to planet Earth, monitoring the conditions from space, CO2 coming to the atmosphere, the behavior of the oceans is helping us to understand what's going on the planet now. Those observations, that scientific research that's being done from that data is critical to understanding, Earth right now. The work that NASA does in space physics, monitoring the sun, understanding solar flares, those have a huge effect here on the Earth. And that's not even getting to the many things NASA does. There's a lot of things NASA does are critical from a point of view of protecting humans right now. And I think you have to look at these hazards in terms of how likely they are to affect us, how much of a danger it is, and apportion your money. We should be looking at the asteroid risk, but we should also be monitoring the sun. We should also be understanding planetary atmospheres so that we understand what the fate of our own atmosphere is.
Yeah, I agree. And the NASA charter, started way back in 1958, says that the space agency is in existence to learn about our space environment, to scientifically investigate the solar system and the universe, but also to share those results with us so that we become a more viable economic and influential power in the world. That's the reason the agency was established in the first place. So we have other missions for NASA besides planetary defense, which should be one of many worthy topics to undertake. And as I mentioned before, the amount of money or resources needed to deal with the asteroid hazard is on the order of a few tens of millions of dollars per year to mount the telescopic searches and do the mission studies that are required. Only in the case of an actual threat from an asteroid would you actually have to spend money to build a spacecraft to go and deflect something. You don't need a fleet of interceptors on the ground at all. That's just science fiction.
I know from talking to Rusty in previous shows, the expenditures for planetary defense should be somehow proportioned and borne by countries all around the world, because it's not just protecting the U.S. and U.S. taxpayers from an incoming. Is there any progress? Is there any you know, international support, not in theory that we support doing this, but in really coming to terms with how these projects get funded and shared and who has responsibility and how collective that responsibility is?
This is very specifically happening right now. The Association of Space Explorers, the astronaut organization, a global organization, we spent 2 years with a series of workshops drafting with our panel of experts an agreement for the UN to consider. And the report is called Asteroid Threats, a Call for Global Response, and it's on the Association of Space Explorers website. So that report just got submitted to the UN. It'll be formally received by them in February of this coming year. And then in June, it will start into discussion at the Committee on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space over in Vienna. And so that process of the diplomats now, along with their scientific advisors, looking at this agreement, seeing if it's desirable, modifying it if necessary, will take several years beyond that. And our role as the association, along with our panel of experts on the asteroid threat mitigation that we composed, our role will be to testify and to support and to keep public scrutiny and public attention on this topic of planetary defense and why the international community should be prepared to act in the future. So now we're at the point where we can actually discuss this hazard in an international way. And we've gotten quite strong and supportive responses from both some of the spacefaring countries and also a lot of countries who recognize that they may not have a space program, but they are certainly the same target zone as everybody else is when it comes to being struck by a future asteroid.
We have a question from Sarah in Albuquerque. Do either of you think that we will ever discover an Earth-like planet someplace out there that can actually sustain life like we have on Earth?
Well, I'll take a little bit of a stab at that. Our last chapter in planetology is about the search for other Earths and exoplanets, extrasolar planets. We have discovered an entire zoo of worlds circling other stars, more than 300 at the last count, and we can keep up with that count as it goes on at the website that's listed in our bibliography, NASA's Quest website. And that search is really fascinating because we're looking, obviously, for worlds that are about the same size as Earth in the same habitable zone where temperatures and the environment provided by its parent star are such that life might exist there. First of all, liquid water on the surface, which we consider essential to life, a protective atmospheric envelope, and then the temperatures and conditions for life to exist. So we don't have the technology yet to find bodies as small as Earth around other stars. We're maybe 10 to 15 years away from deploying telescopes in space and on the ground that can do that job. But that's the motivation for advancing that technology, is we might be able to detect, first, that such Earths exist, second, whether they have a chemical composition that is similar to ours, and third, whether or not we see chemical compounds in the atmospheres of those bodies that might be tracers of the presence of life.
Ellen?
Yeah, I'd say I'm extremely optimistic about it, and I think one of the main thing that's really interesting when you're out looking, you think of, okay, what are the ingredients that, you know, you need for life, and you need some sort of source of energy. You need these hydrocarbon compounds, and you need liquid water. So we know all the signatures to look for. But I think even more than that, you need those conditions to be stable for hundreds of millions of years, if not over a billion years, to have a kind of niche where not only can life evolve, but it can take hold. And so I think as we go out, we're going to be certainly looking for those conditions, but also, you know, places in a solar system where life could be in conditions long-lasting enough that it could evolve. Tom talked earlier about how probably early in Earth's history we went through this huge bombardment, which life might have evolved and gotten sterilized and then evolved again. And so it's that kind of more benign conditions that you need to persist for some amount of time to allow life to take hold. And those are the conditions we're really looking for as we go out beyond Earth looking for life.
Sarah sent in a follow-up and said, you're mentioning qualifications for life that are based on what we know. I know it's a hard question, but could life exist in terms that we might not recognize and therefore might not see it?
Absolutely. I think every time that we've really made a strong assumption of saying, you know, the Earth is exactly like this, and so this is what we're going to look for because this is how we understand the Earth. In general, we've been maybe always a little bit wrong and sometimes a lot wrong. And right now, we understand life the way it evolved here on Earth, and so those are the conditions that we're going out looking for. Could life have evolved under different conditions? Boy, we just don't know. And that's, you have to, you know, as a scientist, you have to say, I need data. I need to extrapolate from data in a reasonable way. And so we go with what we have. But is the scope likely much larger than that? Yeah, and that's what I think is exciting. You know, if we're going to go to Titan at some point. We're going to be in the clouds of Venus. We're going to be investigating Europa. And I'm hoping we're going to find life forms that are of a sort we haven't even thought of before because, you know, that's where you really learn is when you get surprised.
How would you know they're life forms?
Well, it's tough to do that remotely with telescopes, for example, especially if they're at the microbial level. And if they don't use chemistry or the hydrocarbon-based life that we see here, it might be hard for us to figure out that that's actually a signature of life. But you know, I think the ultimate proof that we're not alone might come from listening in on our radio telescopes for communications or transmissions from intelligent civilizations elsewhere. And I have optimism that within my lifetime, as the search for extraterrestrial intelligence becomes more sophisticated and more sensitive with our technology, that we'll actually receive some of those radio signals. I would hope that whatever kind of life might evolve in this universe or in this galaxy, it'll eventually stumble upon the laws of physics and figure out how to transmit information across interstellar distances. And we think we understand how to listen for that information, and I hope that we'll receive it.
Do you think saying most scientists is a huge number, of course, but do you think most scientists are open to finding some sort of life outside of Earth?
I sure think so. I think that given the statistics of how many stars in the Milky Way there are, 100 billion or more, and the frequency with which we've been finding planets around some of those nearby stars with our crude techniques for looking for extrasolar planets, the statistics are that planets around other stars seem to be rather commonplace. And just those sheer numbers would invite you to speculate that some of them will be in a habitable zone, and some of them will have had the stability in their solar systems to let life get started. And one would hope that life is rather plentiful elsewhere in the Milky Way. The big question so far is, why haven't we heard of it so far? Even in a half a century of listening, we might expect to hear lots of noise out there from other civilizations, and yet we don't. So either we're just too unsophisticated to detect it at this point, or perhaps we're the first ones to start listening.
Now, don't you know,
to me,
NASA's covering it up. Don't you know that? It's all hidden. Time for one more question. Todd in Denver says, do either of you or both of you have a favorite chapter or subject in the book?
Go ahead, Ellen.
Oh, well, for me, it would probably, I actually loved all of it. I loved working with the images, and it was so much fun working with Tom, but I would say by far my favorite chapter would have to be the one on volcanoes. I do primarily study volcanoes, both here on Earth. I do field work at Mount Etna and in Hawaii, and being able to spend time sort of wandering through the solar system's volcanoes was a lot of fun for me.
Have you ever been inside a volcano?
I have stuck my head over the edge of one of the main calderas on Mount Etna, and it really was looking like, you know, looking into your vision of hell, you know, sulfur gas and lava, pounding and booming down in the bottom of the caldera. So, yeah, I've done quite a bit of field work at active volcanoes.
Tom, what is your favorite?
Well, I think the combination of looking down at the Earth from the space shuttle at geological wonders of the Earth, gave me a real appreciation for how dynamic our world is. And, you know, the thing that you see all over the world from orbit is how the world has been carved up by running water. And I think I learned the most in researching and writing a chapter about water-driven erosion, both on Earth and perhaps on Mars now. And, you know, going down to the bottom of the Grand Canyon and viewing the Grand Canyon from a couple hundred miles up, you put those two experiences together, and it's just it just knocks your socks off. So I really had a lot of fun with studying how our planet's been shaped by the long-lasting force of running water.
Listeners, there's a picture, it's a double-page picture in the book called Desert Pavement, and it shows the floor of Gusev Crater on Mars, and then there's an insert with a Jeep with some people driving away across the Sahara, and honest to God, it looks like it's a double take. How the hell did they get that Jeep up there on Mars? Or could you be looking at one of the robots or something? They're almost looking identical. It's unbelievable.
A lot of the comparisons that we have in the book between Mars and the Earth are stunning and startling. I mean, they're really amazing.
And you can imagine scientists in 1965 when they saw the first images of Mars from Mariner 4 and saw a blasted, crater-ridden landscape, they thought, well, that's it for Mars. It's a pretty dull, uninteresting place. And yet we now know, with our rovers there and the fleet of orbiters that we have around it, how Earth-like it is in many respects. And it's a fascinating place and truly, eerily like some of the desert regions of our planet.
Well, obviously, your collaboration on a book project is a big hit winner. So what's next from the two of you?
I haven't even thought about that.
Well,
it just came out the week before Thanksgiving, so we're still blown away by the fact that it really exists.
Well, this is a really great book. And listeners, the holiday period's coming up, and for your favorite space cadet or a youngster who can get inspired by both text and pictures, this is the one to go for. I'm assuming you can get it every place or online. Planetology, published by National Geographic. You really need to do another one. So
we hope we can do that. We enjoy working together, and we're certainly going to be talking a lot about planetology in the coming months. And we hope that many of your listeners will have a chance to talk to us in depth about the book.
Do you have a website or email if listeners want to communicate you, or should I have them go through me?
Well, mine is astronauttomjones.com, as you mentioned earlier. And of course, planetology is front and center on the homepage there at astronauttomjones.com. And there's a web-based email there that you can contact me through.
Okay.
And I'm estofan at yahoo.com.
Okay. Terrific, and I wish you great luck with the book. Is there any way this will be a National Geographic special?
Well, Ellen, you can talk about that.
Well, we're certainly thinking about it. It would lend itself to a very visual presentation.
Absolutely, and I hope that you can make that happen. And if you do, please let me know, and I'll promote it. And if you want to do a show about it beforehand, I will do that. But I would love to promote that on the program.
Well, thank you so much for having us. It's a lot of fun for us to be able to talk about the book.
Well, it's a great book. And listeners, again, National Geographic published it, Planetology, Unlocking the Secrets of the Solar System. So my best to you both for a great holiday season, and thanks for being on the Space Show.
You're welcome.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Listeners, that's it. Remember, special show Thursday, not Friday. Thursday on the upcoming AIAA conference. Bob Dickman is with us along with another gentleman from AIAA and Carnegie Mellon, and we're going to be talking about what is unique about that conference in Orlando in early January. Thank you all for listening to The Space Show.